The Marvel Handbook A3, Alpha Primitives, American Eagle, Anaconda, and Anger the Screamer.
Cyclops, the Crimson Dynamo,
Daredevil,
Doctor Strange,
the Fantastic Four,
Galactus, Ghost Rider, Blue Cycle Hero,
Hellcat,
Howard the Duck,
the Human Torch,
the Incredible Hulk,
Bruce Banner,
Invincible Girl,
Iron Man,
MODOK,
I need a
Mr. Fantastic,
Nemesis, Lord Prince of the Deep,
Nightcrawler,
Odin,
Professor X,
The Punisher,
Rick Jones,
Sergeant Fury,
The She-Hulk,
Silver Surfer,
Spider-Man,
Spider-Woman,
Scorpion, the X-Men, The Thing, Ben Grimm,
The Mighty Thor,
Stadium Man,
Wolverine,
The Marvel Superheroes.
All we have to do is decide who goes and who stays to hold off a wave of primates and hide the terrible.
I'm a legal machine. With me is
Senor Fix It.
You can find me on Stitcher. And if you're listening to this, you already know where to find me because you're subscribed to this feed, hopefully. Today, we're going to cover Alpha Primitives. Alpha Primitives, gosh darn slave labor, genetically engineered slave labor for the Inhumans. They are all about 5'7" tall, live for 42 years, asexual.
With green eyes.
Is that what it said?
Did I miss
that?
I think
so. Okay.
Who was the creator of them? It wasn't a Celestial.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the comic book creators.
No.
Stanley and Jack Kirby, I believe.
Yeah, but no, the creators,
that order.
They said that
the Inhumans created them, right? So they can focus more on
expanding. No, the Inhumans at the time, they wanted the Inhumans to seek knowledge. So they created the Alpha Primes to do all the
Avadar.
Day-to-day. Yeah.
Geneticist Avadar.
Was he one of the Celestials or what was he?
He's Avadar. I didn't do that. He'd be AV. We're on AL. I don't want to do a spoiler.
Yeah.
Avadar was a geneticist of the Inhuman species living 4,000 years ago.
A lot of these characters always have Celestial roots somewhere. Because Celestials created the Kree anyway. Because remember, the Celestials are the ones that are seeding the Marvel Universe with life. And then if they think it's great, they give a thumbs up. If they don't, and they start all over.
Wanting the Inhumans to focus on broadening their knowledge, he genetically engineered these...
A subclass.
Yeah.
Slave class.
Yeah.
Because, again, they have no culture.
Yeah.
They have no recreation.
Who writes the book on whether or not they have a culture?
That's right.
True.
Because this could all be Inhuman.
But, again, don't they have the mentality of like a six-year-old?
Yeah. They give them the vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of a small child. So, I mean, they might want to go outside with magnifying glasses and burn ants, and
well,
that's about it.
That's just what they give them. It's because they limit their... Have you tried to teach?
Well, again...
Alpha Primitive? You know? You're only as good as your education system, right? How do you keep the poor? Poor. You keep them stupid.
So they're poor?
I mean, how do you keep the stupid stupid? You keep them poor? I don't know. Look, it's some... in circle.
Potato, potato. They were made for menial work, so service industries, farming. Now, the sad thing is, they're all male, so there's no female Alpha Primes. They're only made through cloning.
They're primitives.
Prime. Oh, my bad. They're cloned, and it's illegal to clone anymore, so there's only 500 in existence.
I didn't think it put a number. It just said their numbers were dwindling, because they live for 42 years.
No, it actually
years.
Does. It says in the beginning.
It doesn't matter, because it's an old entry, so they're probably off dead now anyway.
Yeah. They have tattooed, born to die.
So the Alpha Primitives have an expiration date, and they're no longer producing this
42
product.
Years, apparently.
Yeah.
So, have either of you ever encountered these characters in a comic book?
Man, I don't know. I mean, I read the J. Lee, Paul Jenkins?
Yeah.
Well, Jay Lee. Were the Alpha Primitives in that?
Yeah.
Yep.
Were they? I am completely...
They did appear in the horrible Inhumans TV show.
Actually, I'm not so sure that's...
I thought they
correct.
Did.
My recollection from the television series was that the Inhumans, or the members of that race that did not manifest superpowers, had to engage in menial labor, most especially mining, and there did not have any deviants that I saw in all of the... No, deviants is Celestials. I can't keep track, right? Deviants is Eternals?
Maybe.
Eternals, maybe.
Oh, right. So these groups all had like classes that they used for slave labor?
I don't know if deviants were a subclass. They were ostracized, I think, though.
Mm-hmm.
So on the TV show, they were still regular people who procreated and had families and stuff. And that was actually where the conflict was, is they were essentially a slave class, or probably more of a serf class, like a serfdom,
mm-hmm.
for the most part. So when we saw the Alpha Primitives in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it was actually on Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. The way they were represented there, though, you may recall in Season 3, they had the Hive, this creature that was like a deified...
Essentially. In that other universe.
And they created these clones that were like zombies, essentially. They're like mostly faceless zombies, and they swarm the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. toward the end of season 3. Do you remember that?
Oh, when they attacked the base.
Yeah, they were basically
That's right. Yeah, I remember.
So that's how they were treated on in the cinematic universe. But oddly enough, there are actual alpha primitives in the Marvel Cinematic Universe via Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., assuming that's remotely canon, although my understanding is that post-snapping, I don't even think they're in their canon anymore.
Why did the Inhumans decide to finally free them at the end? It says in there that they kind of just freed them, and they actually go down there and just check up on them and check on their, you know, make sure everything's okay, because they don't want to leave the tunnels.
Like, somebody pointed out that was horrible, even under the circumstances, that was still really horrible. Because, I mean, they do everything they can to dehumanize them in the entry. Well, they're not very smart, they don't procreate, they have no culture, and blah, blah, blah. It's like, they're still slaves,
they did make a point to say, though, that some of them, it's just like, all they know is work, so they just work.
Yeah, as soon as they set them free, they're like, okay, so I'm going to go back doing what I was doing before, because, like, I don't know anything else. Because it literally says they just went back to the things they were before, so.
They're the unsullied.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I think the analogy would be more like they would be livestock, essentially. Like, they may be humanoid.
They don't eat them, fool. You think that?
No, like,
you think they're eating alpha primitive?
We don't eat horses, but we still
try the new alpha primitive burger. You saw the alpha primitive burger at a Whopper? Have you tried the new alpha primitive Whopper?
No, I'm wondering if maybe it's like some sort of a weird metaphor, some sort of vegan thing, where if they walked upright and looked like humans, would you make them plow your fields? Like, maybe that's what they were going for. I don't know. I've never read any of those appearances. Mr. Fix-It, did you read the follow-up miniseries, the one that Jose Ladron did?
No.
Because they're in that.
I read the Paul Jenkins one.
They've appeared in a total of 66 comics, roughly, and the majority of a large percentage of those are reprints of the other comics.
Okay.
So it's probably only a handful of books. A few dozen stories, probably, total. And it looks like fairly minor roles in most of them, so I don't know.
What was the name of Black Bolt's brother?
Maximus the Mad?
Yeah. Didn't he always use them as kind of an army?
I
think in one of the books I read, he used some kind of technology to make them a little smarter, where he could at least control them in terms of, like, he could lead them.
They did a motion comic, right?
I remember reading something about that, reading one of those books, because I'm thinking, okay, and he's down there with them, and he's, like, trying to rile them up so that they can overthrow, because, again, they have no fear.
And that was essentially the plot in the TV show, with the exception of they were not alpha primitives, they were sentience, full sentience.
No.
But they did a motion comic of the J. Lee Paul Jenkins miniseries, right?
I believe so, but I've never seen it.
Okay, because I mean, they're in about the last four issues of the miniseries, so probably that played a role. I assume that a lot of what happened in that maxi series was the basis for the TV show, so probably. Like, give me a thumbs up, like a Celestial would.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think. So when did this entry come out?
83.
So they were already free by 83?
Yeah. Well, they were introduced in like Fantastic Four 50 something. Yeah. So you're talking about 66 or so.
Yeah.
So maybe. That's still a good 20 years of slavedom.
Ugh.
Well, remember, they only lived 42 years, so.
I am the American Eagle. Eyes of a sparrow. Right hand branch. Left hand arrow. Chasing a dollar. And an impala.
Hey, what's up, guys? This is Derek WC from History of Comics on Film and Fanholes Podcast, talking about the official handbook of the Marvel Universe.
American Eagle.
Yeah, Jason Strongbow. This is cool, because I should just preface this. I'm the guy on Gimme That Star Trek that was pimping out Chakotay on the tier list and everything. I'm always into it when I see Native American superheroes and stuff like that. And I know you were kind of like, I was listening to the episode you guys did about the first appearance of Black Panther, because for me, like, you know how, like, Michael Bailey has to explain to his wife about Laurie Lamaris? I kind of had that thing with a buddy with Wyatt Wingfoot, because I love Wyatt Wingfoot. I think he's super cool. I think he was reading Earth X and he's like, who's this guy? And I'm like, he's Wyatt Wingfoot, but, like, without any other explanation, you know. And then I sort of had to explain who he was, basically, that he was Johnny Storm's friend and he was on a Native American reservation and he eventually starts dating She-Hulk. That's why he's in Earth X side by side with Captain America as, like, a new Falcon. And, you know, just kind of explaining, like, why I thought that was super cool and kind of educating a friend on Marvel obscura history and everything. And then I had never read Marvel 2-in-1 Annual 6, his first appearance, until you asked me to do this. And the fact that Wyatt Wingfoot's in that issue totally legitimizes American Eagle for me, because he's part of his origin. There's some sense of legitimacy. They're both involved, and it's a character that I knew very well, and a character that I guess I'd have to say the first time I was introduced to him and I thought he was super cool in the arc was during Warren Ellis's Thunderbolts. Since I am part of a Thunderbolts podcast, my nefarious plan was, not only do I like the characters that we're discussing, but you'll find a lot of these characters are Thunderbolts related, including American Eagle, who was in that Suicide Squad-esque interpretation of the Thunderbolts post-Civil War, where they're, as my buddy Mike likes to say, the Thunderbolts are the man, and they're going after like all these unregistered superheroes and stuff in the aftermath of Civil War. He's got a cool rep, and I got to see it as opposed to reading about it, because there's like that one Jason Aaron one-shot, and it made me think, I'm super glad I read Scalp now, and then I went back, reread that American Eagle one-shot that Jason Aaron wrote, and I'm like, I totally like sort of see the lineage or the commonality or whatever, and when he shows up in that special, they're kind of like, Jason Strongbow beat up Kazar with one hit, arm wrestled the Thing, kicked out a bullseye, you know, and you're like going down the list of like all the cool things he's done, and it was kind of fun to read that Marvel 2-in-1 annual and see some of that stuff firsthand. Warren Ellis pokes some fun at the original costume and everything, so you've got like the Ron Wilson design costume, I think, okay with it, except for it seemed like he kind of got lumped in with all the Contest of Champion type heroes of the world, I guess, in that, where I noticed a lot of his appearances after that Marvel 2-in-1 annual were just these large shots of a conglomeration of heroes fighting some great battle or some assemblage of heroes. You remember when the Incredible Hulk had Bruce Banner's mind and they gave him like big parade and everything, and they're like, dude, you're cool, man, you're a hero, Hulk. And you know, Hulk's like shedding a tear because he's like, I'm a hero. During that, I think one of the heroes way in the background giving him props was American Eagle. There's a bunch of stuff like that. The first time I had ever seen him was in the Thunderbolts, and as opposed to wearing the original costume, he's in this cool biker outfit. His biker helmet has got that eagle motif, and I guess if I had my dithers, not like they're ever going to do this, but if they were going to make a Marvel Legends of American Eagle, I'd probably, in a move totally counter to my normal way of thinking, I'd probably want the quote-unquote modern version of his outfit as opposed to the quote-unquote classic version. But yeah, I do dig the character a whole bunch.
To carry on with that, I'm looking at the artwork, and I don't think it's the strongest design. I do agree with you that he's a guy who benefited from being modernized. I don't think you could actually say the words classic American Eagle with a straight face, because Fair enough.
Have you seen the American Eagle outfit from Marvel Comics Presents Backups? Those are terrible, dude. This makes those look... I mean, like in that, he looks like... what's the dude from the Muppets that has the eagle? Yeah, like Sam the Eagle. Imagine American Eagle, but he literally has a spandex outfit and looks like he's got a big beak on his headgear. Oh my gosh. This is Ron Wilson, and I think those backups are done by Ron Wilson. And I always feel bad asking this, and people don't ever really seem to give me a straight answer, but I remember I met Chris Marinen at a con, and you're probably familiar with him from his work on Wonder Woman and stuff like that. He did a Nova series back in the 90s where everybody had these big giant pecs, and Nova had this big ponytail, super duper 90s. Did they make you draw like that? Because I know that's not like your regular, everybody was forced to sort of draw like Dan Panison or Rob Liefeld or something. You see it in all kinds of comics from that era, even stuff like the Nom. All of a sudden everybody has thunder thighs and all this kind of crazy speed lines and cross hatching for no good reason on their face or whatever. I was looking at some of those Marvel Comics Presents backups. I get what you're saying. This is not the greatest design in the world for this, you know, I know laughably, you know, quote unquote classic costume for American Eagle. But let me put it this way. If I had tiers of how I want the Marvel Legend to look, it'd be the modern and then this, let's call it first appearance, Frank. So we don't have to offend anybody's sensibilities, but let's say first appearance American Eagle and then 90s American Eagle. It's like, you know what I don't want? I don't want the 90s American Eagle. He's got a bandolier with bullets or something and a bunch of pouches and this big Sam the Eagle beak on his mask, which looks super lame.
I was trying to actually remember where I knew this character from outside of Ohotmu, because as with Who's Who, there's a lot of instances where because I read the reference book more than I read the comic books, there are a lot of characters I know more from the reference book. And until you mentioned that run of Marvel Comics Presents stories, I wasn't sure that I'd ever read an American Eagle comic book. I actually kind of like the weird little beak thing he had going on, but honestly, I because I don't have the reference in front of me, I don't recall much beyond him having that little beak thing on his nose. But I definitely liked it better than this. Liquid Television used to have a stop motion animated segment about an angry Daisy. There's a flower that actually would ride a motorcycle and start fires and stuff.
Are you trying to say that American Eagle looks like El Cid? Is that where you're going with this?
I am El Cid. I am the self-proclaimed liberator of the plant population.
He looks like he has flowers erupting out of his head. He looks like Daisy Man. And then aside from all the little feathers along his pants, I don't see anything of real distinction in the costume here. So I'd actually would favor the Marvel Comics Presents suit over this one. But I also agree that the modern look is... much less horrible.
But that's because of the profile of the Ohotmu book here. If you look at that little panel in the right-hand corner, I mean, he doesn't look like Daisy Man there, does he?
No, true,
like,
true. I don't know that that's something you necessarily want to wear into battle. Blackface, yellowface, would that be redface then? To go there with
But it seems like that's probably why he got lumped in with all those characters from the Contest of Champions. Whenever they would try to do those Planet DC where they had like, or even, you know, Global Guardian, where it's like, oh, we're going to identify them first by the country, nation, and or race that they hail from. So they put these overly obvious things where it's like Shamrock has like a green leotard and a big Shamrock on her chest or whatever. You know what I mean? Like where it's like, it's just one of those things where you were supposed to identify it without putting too much thought into it, I think.
It's a small world after all the ride turned into a comic book. I don't know a lot of the history of Contest of Champions, yeah. But my understanding is that part of the drive of that was that Marvel's selling in international territories and they're getting requests from those territories for superheroes from the fans there. And so they just hacked out these contrived heroes based on stereotypes of the individual nations. You talked to Siskoid about Alpha Flight. There's a lot of caricatures there, but it's still nice to have a home team at least. And so I guess on some of these countries, if you've got nothing but Shamrock and Jack-O-Lantern, you're like, well, at least I've got these guys, you know.
For me, I've never had any one single superheroic character that was Chickasaw, which is what my background is. But anytime I saw somebody, it was kind of like what you're talking about, like sort of a home team representation, you know, where you could be like, oh, cool. Like, that's awesome. I think that was, you know, at least for this character in particular, but also for like Wyatt Wingfoot or guys like Warpath and Thunderbird, you know, like different characters like that, that I would key in on, and Puma even, you know. And I know some of those characters are not necessarily characters that you're fond of, but for me, that was always the standout for me, because I think the only time I ever heard Chickasaw ever mentioned was in Jimmy Palmiotti, Jonah Hex, where the tribe was mentioned as part of a story and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, cool. And that made me light up like no tomorrow. And it was kind of like a recent comic and everything. But as far as this goes, to me, it's like that was one of those things where I could look at this character, really honestly was introduced to the modern version. So I didn't really know too much about this version. And so I just kind of looked at it as a, probably like Warren Ellis did. Like, I mean, he's kind of cracking jokes about this costume in the Thunderbolts appearance, but then also he doesn't kill it. Like, he doesn't put two in the back of its skull and just bury it in the desert. He makes the comment, yeah, this was a little wacky, this costume, Jason, like back in the day, and his buddy that's talking to him. But then they smooth it over by saying, hey, look, man, it was a different time. Like, yes, I looked like I was going to the YMCA, but it was a different time. So it's like they kind of poke fun at it, but also say, hey, look, they were trying to do superheroic representation that also tied in with culture, and they probably went a little overboard in retrospect.
Just because you wore hammer pants in the 90s doesn't disqualify you from service for the rest of your life. You just chuckle and you move on, you know? It's not that big of a deal.
Yeah, just because you had that one wackadoo haircut back in the day, or you teased your hair up in the high school yearbook when you were trying to be a hot little teenage girl or something, you could still get away with having, like, you know, a nice normal haircut like 20 years later or whatever.
Look, I'd never heard the word mullet until after I'd already had and lost one. So, you know, I can't help that. I didn't know.
Talking about, like, the modern representation of them, I don't know if you've ever read this series or not, but the... How do I phrase this? Because they reboot series so much. The post-initiative War Machine series was where Rhodey was part cyborg and stuff, and his face was all messed up, and he was going on a rampage fighting Norman Osborn as Hammer. He ends up putting up Rhodey's mom on his res, so she's got a home there and everything. And then when the fight comes to the Navajo reservation, then American Eagle has to get involved and everything. They have this cool throwdown with one another, and I don't know, Rhodey almost Batmans his Superman, I guess, in a way, you know, like Dark Knight Return style, but not that grim, more clever trickery type way and stuff. But then by the end of it, they team up and have a good send off with one another. I think that might have been one of those things where it's like, you know, dude who knocked Kazer out with one blow, he's got all this Marvel U cred that is not unearned. I think it's not like he just showed up out of nowhere and started trouncing people per se. He's had a number of appearances, as limited as they were. If you follow his trajectory of his superhero career, he actually made his bones, I think, you know, at least for me.
You can move past the funky look. You can move past a dearth of appearances. So long as what you have out there has some quality to it, has some appeal to it. It sounds like that's what happened with this character. I haven't had a lot of exposure to him, but I don't disqualify him either. He seems, basically from what you're telling me, he seems like a pretty cool dude. Definitely see the potential there.
Fortunately, it doesn't look like they did way too much with him after Fear itself, I think, because he had a little backup strip in one of the miniseries in there. If I was going to point to highlights, try to twist your arm and convince you he's a cool character, the Thunderbolts Ellis run, I think he's in it for 5 issues, span of a trade. I think 112 to 116, he makes appearances in that. And then the Jason Aaron thing, I think, was like a digital comic, and then it got collected later in a print comic. And it's just a little old-fashioned Justice where, like, he basically fights with Cottonmouth from the Serpent Society. Like, Cottonmouth ends up, like, on the res, and he's got some girl hostage. So then it's, like, this kind of... I think it was, like, the Texas Twister and some of those Initiative guys were, like, trying to hunt him down. But then, again, once they were on Indian reservation territory, it's, like, out of their jurisdiction. So he's the superhero sheriff in that vicinity, you know? So he goes out to deal with Cottonmouth and stuff like that. Like, and then that two... I think it's War Machine 6 and 7. Those are the stories I'd point to, you know, other than maybe historically reading his first appearance to see where he hailed from.
What's going on up there?
Anaconda! Anaconda!
As Odell Abner Dracula. Twitter's Odell Dracula's. Most of that stuff should kind of stand on its own terms. I mean, it's just goofy drawings of superheroes and zombies.
So why'd you want to pick Anaconda of all the people?
After reading the profile, I realized I didn't know as much about her as I thought. But the thing that stuck out about her is that she's Polish. Well, I'm assuming she's Polish just based on her name. And she looks like, I don't know if this is too much information, but she kind of looks like one of my aunts. Between that and the Polish stuff, I thought, yeah, you know, she's as good as anybody else. I mean, who else is there in fiction? You got like Banachek, I think the bartender on The Simpsons. Maybe that's about it. Meathead on All in the Family.
I think most World War II movies had at least one Polish guy in each company. So you have that going for you.
That's true. I think I might have been first introduced to her by the handbook. My memories of her are all mixed up with Dr. Dorcas and Atuma and all these Atlanteans. And I think it was just that she had those scales and like the fins on her face that I just kind of lumped her in with them. And then it might have been the first in-comic appearance, might have been that X-Men installment of Atlantis Attacks. I think she was in there with the Serpent Society.
That sounds right. I think I remember that. I think it was like Neil Vokes or Mike Vosburgh or somebody really random, because the X-Men annuals, I believe this is what that was, the Uncanny X-Men annual, they had developed this pedigree with Art Adams doing them and Alan Davis. And all of a sudden you had this guy that just wasn't quite up to that level. And it happened to be with Anaconda and the Serpent Society. There's a whole bunch of stuff that doesn't belong in this comic book, is the way I felt when I read it.
Yeah, and they were hard. That annual was when I might have been like the Outback time or right before the Outback time, like the Siege Perilous stuff going on. My friends and I in grade school, we passed around those X-Men annuals and those New Mutant annuals and, you know, Alan Davis and Art Adams. And it was really stuff we latched onto. But then to read about the X-Men in that annual, it was just really hard to track. I think there might have been like a Jubilee backup story in there too or something. I don't know. It didn't make sense. And then they had that guy from Cloak and Dagger in it too.
Wasn't there a deal like one of the female X-Men had been possessed or mind swapped or something and tried to have sex with Wolverine while they were in the other person's body? Am I remembering that right?
Oh boy. Kind of, probably. What they were doing with the Atlantis Attacks was Seth was trying to get 7 brides. And so he was going around and he had his minions, who I think it was some guy from like the Eternals or something, who I didn't really know him either, but they were trying to like draw in these superheroines who could stand to be in a relationship with Seth and like bear his snake children or something really gross. And so it might have been like Marvel Girl was possessed by the snake demon or something like that. And there was a scene that played out like you were talking about.
I love that you're saying that guy from the Eternals, which I'm pretty sure is the official description of every Eternal. Do they have individual names, or it's always just, oh yeah, that guy, that Eternal guy? I think that's
He's got a name you can't pronounce. It's like Gwar or Gwar or Gar or something like that. He's got, I mean, I could draw you a picture of him, but I couldn't tell you how to pronounce his dumb name.
Do you recall what role Anaconda played in that one?
There's a MacGuffin. Like, there was a magic statue that was going to help focus Seth. Manifestation in this plane was buried in Indiana or something, and then she just went with the Serpent Society to get it, and then they got their
chimichangas
handed to them by the X-Men. I remember thinking that she had snake heads for hands, but I haven't been able to find that.
They've got an image on the entry from an old Marvel 2-in-1. I think it might be her first appearance. If I remember correctly, there was a really distinctive cover. I think it might have been George Perez or maybe Perez Inks, where she's ensnaring the thing in her snake arms.
When I first picked her, I thought that she had like snake heads, like little snake eyes and snake mouths on forehands, as opposed to having fingers and thumbs. I think that might be one of the Salem Seven, now that I think about it. Her handbook pictures, she has like flesh-colored fists, but like reading through this handbook entry, it says that Roxxon took out her arm and leg bones and put in adamantium snake skeletons inside of her limbs, basically, and that's how she can stretch and do all this nonsense. But Anaconda, she's got snake powers and she can constrict you, like, okay, cool. But then you think about, like, oh, they put snake skeletons in her dang arms, and then you start to think, like, well, can snakes really stretch? Because that the power that snakes have, I don't know. And then it all kind of starts to fall apart. I came into this thinking, like, oh yeah, Anaconda, now that I gave the entry once over, I'm like, what the heck, Anaconda? It got really kind of like a DC Silver Age vibe to it after reading this.
Actually, the more you're talking about it, the more I'm kind of into it. I'm trying to picture, I guess the adamantium is telescoping. And so now I want to see the Elliot R. Brown diagram of what her skeleton would look like, if it has all these little sections to it and stuff.
I mean, I'm not a biologist, but I think that snakes are using their rib cage when they're doing that too. And so does she have like hundreds of tiny adamantium ribs in her limbs? I don't understand how she's put herself back together after you stretch out like that. She'd be like an octopus lady. And then they make the point of saying when she extends her limbs in this fashion, the muscle tissue gorges with blood, swelling the limbs so that each looks like a massive, powerful snake, which is cool and everything. But I'm old. I do stuff like I stand up too fast. The blood in my body doesn't all stand up with me. And I kind of go like, I don't know how she can wear her blood, how that works. You know, I think if you were like stretching giant limbs around Iron Man, she'd probably faint.
That's one of those deals where sometimes you're better off not explaining it. That's absolutely in opposition to what Ohotmu is all about. It's all about trying to over-explain through just the most ridiculous pseudoscience how this could possibly work in a realistic world. Still, I don't know. I really enjoy them trying, because it's so much weirder to try to explain how her powers work than to just be like, oh yeah, her limbs become snakes.
You know, right. That's the thing. You take it at face value, like, oh, her limbs become snakes. So there you go. That's power you can have.
but the detail they're trying to go to, the bizarre ways they're trying to figure out how this is supposed to work, I'm here for it.
I think that might have been how I went from like reading my dad and uncle's comics they left laying around into fandom, was because of material like this, where you're, you know, it's like, oh, it's not just he gets bigger, he shunts mass in from an extra dimension, and now that's why he's, you know, that kind of nonsense.
Anaconda is not a character I tend to think a lot about. I don't come across her very often. She appears mostly, in my experience at least, in like Gruenwald Captain Americas, and not necessarily the ones that I gravitated towards, like during some of the time periods where I wasn't super into it. So I've only ever really kind of brushed against her in terms of comic book appearances. But the more I look at her, the more I'm kind of intrigued by her, because I like that she represents an atypical femininity. She's not like a sex pot, and she's not
right. Pure
muscle. It's like she still looks feminine, even though she's well muscled. Interesting to me, because she doesn't look like anybody else. You're never going to confuse Anaconda with any other character, because she's got so much unique stuff going on in her design. Because she looks like a cosmic character, but she's actually maybe a mid-level. And then you think, well, you know, she could be a jobber, but she's going up against the Thing, so she's got to be pretty strong. I actually see potential in her if she were to just work in a different weight class.
Yeah, that was one of the other things I was thinking about, like, what's special about her. She's ahead of her time as far as showing this unique body type for a female character. I don't know if this is appropriate to talk about, but on that new Netflix She-Ra, they've got all kinds of different body types, and it feels like they go way out of their way to lean away from a toy line where it was the same exact body cast in the same exact action figure mold. They went, and it's really a very diverse set of body types. If Anaconda's standing there with 30 other superhero women, you're going to be able to pick her out, you know, just from her profile.
She's very much got like a Master of Universe belt going on, which is not, again, what you'd expect from this type of character. Definitely got the space gladiator thing going on.
Yeah, it's awesome. It is a really cool belt. Kind of looks like a snake wrestling championship belt.
Yeah, you even got like the little, I mean, it's supposed to be a serpent, but you also have sort of these limb things coming off of it as well. It's trippy.
Yeah, it's awesome.
The piece is drawn by Mark Gruenwald, who of course is best known as a writer and editor, and he does a number of pieces in Official Handbook of Marvel Universe, I guess in part because they probably wanted to keep the cost down, and it was an opportunity for him to draw where it didn't come up too much. I don't know if it was because of his skill or just speed. A lot of times these guys just couldn't draw on a monthly basis. This one's a little messed up in dimensions. She seems a little little like she's been compressed. She didn't have enough vertical. But I think otherwise, it's a pretty decent drawing.
It's fine. I think the face looks like he swiped from Byrne. Something about the eyes and the way the lips are set. But other than that, it's all right.
There's another Gruenwald piece in here that I would swear would have been a Frank Miller, at least in the way the face looks. So there might be something to that.
Not so bad. I like her atypical haircut. Everything about her is atypical, I guess. She's got scales on her face and fins on her jaw and all kinds of stuff. But,
I mean, she basically has pseudo sideburns or even a beard.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty great. The more I think about it, the more I'm going to end up really liking her.
Yeah. Sometimes you just got to take a character in isolation. She's pretty much always shown in a group environment, usually among the other Serpent Society members. Mr. Fixit's a big fan of the Serpent Society, but for me, I find that when you have that many snake people all together, they just become kind of a mush. They all look like a bunch of Cobra Law rejects. But when you set some of them off to side, like I love Constrictor, for instance, who sometimes runs with those guys, but not too often. But yeah, sometimes you just got to set them off to side and get a look at them. He's like, this character's got more going for him than I think they're giving credit for.
I generally like the Serpent Society. I feel like every time I come across them, they throw in some kind of like a new random guy in there that I've never, you know, like, oh, is this Boom Slang guy? Was he in there last time? You know, but I don't know. It seems like it might be a fun thing to do, to have some Serpent Society show up and then just throw one or two new guys in there for no reason other than they have a snake name. Like, oh, of course they showed up. Wow, I found my neighbor down the way. He wants to be the new Corn Snake. So he's on the team now. You just pick up random guys as you go.
They do seem to be a welcoming lot. Pretty much you've got a low bar to clear to get into the Serpent Society.
They're not like the Nazi guys in the Sam Wilson Captain America series, are they? That was a different...
Those are the Sons of the Serpent. Two whole different things, although they both turn up in Captain America comics.
I didn't read that stuff yet, but I kind of glimpsed it online. Well, good. I'm glad she's not mixed up with them.
We've got more than enough Nazis running around these days. We don't need to add to their numbers.
Her origin is tied up with Roxxon and the Rand Corporation, or is it Rand in real life? The Brand Corporation in the comics. I mean, that was way over my head back in the day, but that's all got a political component to it, you know? So on one hand, I like it. You got to try to get away from that stuff. And on the other hand, the comics have always taken that and regurgitated it back out at you, even if you didn't understand it at the time.
They've always had some political component to it. It's just that when you're a kid, you don't catch that stuff. And you read it as an adult, you're like, how did I not catch this stuff?
Yeah, I remember where we were on a road trip somewhere and I saw an Exxon sign in real life. I was like, oh my God, is that what? You know, it blew my mind that was because I thought it was the Roxxon Corporation. It just blew me away. I thought it was some kind of fiction bleeding into reality.
David A. Angar. Vocal cords exposed to experimental energy blasts. Shrunk the tumors, but left him with a voice that triggers the central nervous system. Induces immediate catatonia with the slightest whisper.
Angar, make it count.
Angar.
My name is Caroline Wells. I'm a huge comic book fan, both Marvel and DC, and I'm just a nerd working hard to become a voice actor.
Had you read any comics featuring this character, or is it just the appeal of talking about somebody named Angar the Screamer?
Actually, both. When you first look at him, he's like a very radioactive member of the Village People. I mean, goodness gracious. With a name like Angar? Come on. Sometimes I pronounce it in my head like Angar or Anger, because his superpower is like the sonic screams that can mess with your head. So I don't know if I'm going to call him Anger or just Angar. Well, his first look, it's just a very hippy-dippy social activist. Headband, long hair, vest, no shirt, braces on his arms, tie pants or tassels on his little boots. Kind of like a 70s, very, very radioactive, extreme activist from the 70s.
Me personally, I know very little about this fella. I understand that he apparently ended up on Titan, which I think ties him in with Thanos and his extended family. I think he was experimented on, and he ended up getting unleashed against Daredevil and Black Widow. But I'm not sure this guy has made much of an impression in his history in comics beyond being obviously overtly ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, it's comic books. You gotta make your mark somehow. But actually, yeah, he was exposed to the Titan formula, which, well, he was technically introduced too, is sort of Titan treatment through Rex's daughter, Moondragon, who was secretly trying to create a team to go against the Mad Titan Thanos. And Angar's treatment ended up giving him, really, really special vocal cords. He can essentially scream, supersonic scream, for about an hour, and he can only take a little bit of a break for breath. And the scream, it depends how close you are to him. Sometimes the person gets hallucinations, sometimes you see enemies coming at you, sometimes you see personal demons, and other times it just makes your brain go, and then you just pass out.
Isn't he tied into the origins of Songbird from the Thunderbolts?
Mm-hmm. It's almost like a Bonnie and Clyde kind of thing, where they did impersonate Hawkeye and Mockingbird for a little bit, but then they got caught, by Hawkeye and Songbird. They were a part of a team for, reborn bad guys, called the Teenagers, I believe. And he wasn't really Angar the Screamer at that time. He had been kind of transformed into this bound entity called Dream.
He's actually gotten multimedia attention in too. It's a shame given his ties to Moondragon, he didn't make it into Infinity War or Endgame, but at least he got some play in Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I'd forgotten all about that until looking into the character. What do you think about the artwork in the page?
I mean, he just looks like your average demigod activist for going against the man and maybe anarchy and just going against anything and any form of rebellion almost.
Yeah, I'm not sure the art gets across what he does too. He just sort of has these wavy lines around his head. For all I know, he's just tripping.
It's like a pose, hey!
I think he took the brown acid.
Yeah, he did.
This is another one of the pieces by Brian Postman. Not one of the most well-known artists. He did some odds and sods stuff for Marvel in this time period. I mean, it's solid. It's not terrible or anything, but it doesn't seem to live up to the name Angar the Screamer.
Of course. He did have a relationship with his girl named Janice. I think that was her name. But anyway, you know the one I was talking about, he was getting this treatment from a person named Moondragon, or her associate was also Keith Roderick. He was kind of evil dude too, with other intentions other than fighting Thanos. And eventually, at one point, Roderick intended slash teamed up with this being named Eryx, who it's kind of like Abomination of the Hulk, although it's also a form of radiation, this thing, this living entity can just kill with the touch or a strong enough, mental effort on his part. And with Angar, he was driving along in San Francisco, which is where Moondragon thought that Thanos was going to get next. So she put all the people there, and Angar was driving with his girlfriend Janice. He was we're going to take over San Francisco, it's going to be awesome and stuff. But while he's bragging about it, he seems kind of oblivious to the fact that Eryx had already killed his girlfriend. The first time he noticed something was wrong, he leaned in to hug her, but then she just turned into ash and dust. And so that made him go into a full Angar anger mode, which he leveled a good part of San Francisco, but then he ended up damaging his special vocal cords in the process, which Moondragon did up the ante in his supersonic screams. Yeah, it's just, it seems to be one little thing after another that just pushes him down. He gets back up, and I'm a little bit sorry for the dude. They're kind of almost staple run-in for certain characters, Spider-Woman. She saw him being kind of picked on by the cops. They're hey, show me some ID. He's like, no. And then the cops were show us your ID. Then Angar was screaming at them, causing a big ruckus. And she, unfortunately, was in the blast cell at his supersonic screams and forced her to hallucinate every single bad guy that she has fought in the past. Well, he did. Well, at one point, unfortunately, when he was with his partner, Screaming Mimi, who also has some sort of sonic screams, they were running a bank one day that Angar got shot. They did manage to flee the scene into the woods, but Angar passed away from loss of blood, and Mimi just screamed for about an hour and leveled the whole forest. But then, as we all know, Baron Von Zemo found him and her, and he was come with me, I can fix your throat, maybe I can fix your friend here. And then he did fix Screaming Mimi's throat. But then he's join this team called the Thunderbolts, and she did. Zemo did bring back Angar with help from the Fixer, but he didn't really come back as Angar. He came back as this weird pink ghosty looking entity called Scream, which he puppy basically got ghostbustered and stuck in the thing. And it is kind of weird at the end. Being absorbed or ghostbusted by Graviton, that bomber managed to absorb the train and his near essence entity form into this shield, but it comes sort of defense mechanism. And then she smashed it, finally giving him like a part of his eye. Oh, kind of sweet and a little bit sad.
The official listeners of the Marvel Handbook podcast are 20th Century Geek Pod, The 108th Sage, Adriano, AlphaFlight.net, Andre79 Oliveira, Dr. Ange, Anthony Perconti, Batter Bally, Between the Pages, Bronze Age Babies, Castology Podcast, Chris Dunford, Christopher Bush, Collected Edition, Comics in the Golden Age, Constantine.Cotsiras, Daniel French, Fishbonius Sound Design at Fishbonius, who added a baby Bruce Lee ripping stuff Dragon's Heart Out GIF, Dave's Comic Heroes Blog, Debosh, Delvin Dark Web / Felix Leiter, Doc Strange, Dr. G, Nerdologist, Doki Doki Hispanic, Dear Cashton, who added a clapping girl GIF, couldn't place the reference, Ed Moore, Eric Borden, who added, Love the Marvel Handbook, Single Most Awesome Rich History Development Piece, Fan Hills Podcast, Fiendish Fits, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, History of Comics on Film, Into the Weird, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Jeffrey Brown, Jennifer DeRoss, John M. Wilson, Just in Time with the JNT Baggers, Carl Ottersberg, Casper Beaumont, Keith G. Baker, Kenny Crowley Jr., King Dinosaur, Kyle Benning Likes Pound Sign Avengers Comics, Lisa Franklin, The List Game, who included a Calvin and Hobbes gif, Mark Almoro Nicolau, Martin Gray, Matthew Wilkie, Marvel Universe Online, Michael Wagner, Mike, Micro Katinsky, Nexus of All, Nick Spence, Odell Abner Dracula, Omar, Paul K. Bisson, Paul Matthew Carr, PB Ogre, Ranger Gord, Resurrections and Adam Warlick and Thanos Podcast, Ryan Daly Atrian Daly 01, who added, in my fanfiction / headcanon World of Delight, AIM is the natural arch nemesis of Ant-Man and the Wasp. Also, I told you, I could have talked about the Alpha Primitives, but it would have sounded like I was saying Falcon a whole lot. Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Slang Word Resist, Stevenka Nike, Tim Price Podcrasher, Warlord Worlds, who added, Can't Wait to Listen, Weapon Extra, and Wonder Woman, Warrior for Peace Podcast. Finally, this show has been very Jew-centric so far. We do have more women coming who are not robots, but we're always looking for more. Any ladies who are interested in participating in the Marvel Handbook should please contact us via the Rolled Spine Podcast's email or Twitter. Frank doesn't Facebook if he can avoid it, and he usually can.
All characters and concepts appearing in the official handbook of the Marvel Universe and the distinct likenesses thereof are the trademark and copyright of Marvel Entertainment, LLC, a subsidiary of the Walt Disney Company. This has been a not-for-profit fan production from Rolled Spine Podcasts, with any copyrighted materials presented herein presumed covered under fair use, with no infringement intended.